It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me. Have to teach the children about living with each other, 'cause the future will soon be in their hands. Watching us close, they follow our steps. If we do right, I'm sure they'll understand.
Hello, this is Deanna Stimbola, and this is Stimbola and Friends. It is Monday, September 29th, 2014. This radio program does not have any sponsors. Therefore, we are free to talk about some very controversial things and some interesting things that you might not hear about on other radio programs. My website is spingola.com. There you will find information about my books, The Ruling Elite series, as well as a timeline for book 2 and 3, which is, of course, a work in progress. Please also visit the website of a friend and listener who has created and maintains the website, spingolaspeaks.wordpress.com, where you will find all of the audio files for the most recent programs that we have done, either at RBN or at the American Free Press, which is no longer operational, and, of course, this program. I just started a Twitter account, and that is twitter.com/DeannaSpingola. If you have questions during the program, just call in to 646-787-1915. We will be taking questions and comments from the listeners via my email, comment@spingola.com, or, of course, from the chat room, which is spingola.chatango.com. My guests today are Dr. Paul Byrne and Bernice Jones. The website is lifeguardianfoundation.org. And Dr. Byrne also writes for renewamerica.com. And he has these wonderful, wonderful people have been on my program on RBN and also American Free Press, and they just are doing some wonderful work, and it's something that every single person in the country needs to know about. Welcome to the program, Dr. Byrne and Bernice.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you, Delina.
All righty. Bernice, I thought I would like to start out and have you tell us about your son and why you are doing what you are doing. And from your experience, you have used that experience and are helping others to understand the implications of becoming an organ donor and what happened to your family. That was a horrific experience, and one that people need to learn from. And you've been your kind and good heart. You've put that experience. You've used that experience to help others, and that is just a wonderful thing that you're doing.
You know, I did not begin this journey with wanting to do this, trust me. This was very, very difficult for me to speak out. But, you know, God has his ways.
Sure.
He was the one that was loving and gracious to me to be able to speak out about it. You know, Brandon was... very precious. All people are very precious to God. He creates them all. He loves them all. And our time, each and every hour of our life, is by God's hand in His direction. So to take a life, to hasten a life in any way, shape, or form is against God first. So I mean, he's just been very, very gracious, what can I say? But I will just begin very briefly with what our family, it's hard for me to talk about because there's two aspects of this.
It sounds like what somebody's cleaning their desk.
What is that?
I don't know. Is somebody cleaning their desk or opening desk drawers?
Oh,
I'm not sure.
It ended.
I'm not. My mic is so sensitive. People can hear me if I happen to be filing my fingernail. So I.
Oh wow.
Yeah. Okay. Please continue, Bernice.
Okay. Well, it was 15 years ago, and Brandon, my son, was only 16 years old and was playing with a handgun. He shot himself in the head, and at this time, he was unconscious. 911 was called. He was taken by ambulance to a hospital, and the family gathers there, and we sit and we wait to hear what the doctor has to say, with our hands clutched and in prayer. And when the doctor finally did come out and speak to us, it was shortly after Brandon had arrived in ER, and while he was still in ER, the doctor, his first words, that there was no hope for Brandon, that there was no way that he could survive, that he was not breathing on his own, and that he was on the ventilator, a breathing machine, he called it. And he gave us absolutely no hope. He said that he was brain dead. And I had absolutely no intentions of doing anything to help him from what we could understand from his conversation we were having with him, which was very brief. And let me tell you, the trauma that our family was in, it was unacceptable what we were hearing. My husband stood up and demanded that they do everything that they could to help Brandon. So we would wait for an approximate 5 hours. The doctor said that he would take him into surgery, although he felt that there was nothing that could be done. He would be doing it more for us, he said, than for Brandon. We wait, and it seemed like an eternity for the doctor to come back, and he said that there was absolutely no hope. They did everything that they could, and it was time for us to say goodbye to Brandon. We enter the room, and Brandon's head is swollen. Around his eyes are black and blue. His tongue was hanging out. He had a ventilator on him. We're to say goodbye to our Brandon. I had asked our pastor, who was present, to come in and pray for Brandon. The words I will never, ever forget saying to him is that, Brandon, today, the Lord says, you will be with him in paradise. I was in a horrible state of shock. We all were. We were there not very long, and we were asked to leave the room, that there was going to be a test performed. And so we waited for the test results. And the doctor told us that there was no hope. He cannot breathe on his own. He was brain dead. And he was dead. It was time for us to go home. What is a stark reality to us is all that we had to learn after we received Brandon's medical records. After the doctor did come out in ER, a woman came out. She seemed to be very nice. And she would guide us to another room. And that's where we'd sit and wait during the time Brandon was supposed to be having what we thought was a very long surgical procedure. And she would offer us drinks, and she was very polite. She would enter in and out of the room. If we walked down the hall, she followed. She even followed us in after we were told to come and see Brandon to say our goodbyes. this woman was introduced at the time of his so-called declaration of death as an organ procurement agent. The doctor introduced her then. We thought that she had been just a part of the hospital staff. It was to aid us, we surmised. And then she would start in with how Brandon, even after his death, would want to help someone, wouldn't he? I stomped out of the room. I couldn't believe it. In all honesty, I'll say it on open air now, I wanted to slap this woman. The grandparents were present, all of us, the family. All I could hear was choking and crying. We'd just been told our son was dead. And here's this woman. This is the greatest mistake I made, was walking out of that room. My husband and our eldest son, in the worst time of their life, were, I don't even know what to use, persuaded to sign papers in which they had no idea what they were doing at the time. After which I would have to ask for that paperwork because my husband had no recollection of even signing it. So now I'm going to go back in what was discovered. Brandon was unconscious at the time. Immediately after having his accident. But the medical records revealed that in transport to the hospital, Brandon awoke from being unconscious. And he was using purposeful movement, which I might add has absolutely no relevance whatsoever if you are an organ donor. And this is what my son was an organ donor. He was given a paralyzing drug as they tried to intubate him. And this failed. And immediately following, he was given two doses of Valium. He was given atrophine, which is a paralyzing drug, but it, I don't know, Dr. Brinken, I'm a lay person, so I speak in lay language, which traverses and goes into the brain membrane. This causes severe anxiety. It can cause sweating and your pulse to rise, and it sends the body into a shock. And so they would administer him with two shots of Valium. And this drug will stay in Brandon's system. He arrives at ER, and the bedside evaluation, clinical evaluation for brain death, he's put through a series of five very simplistic little procedures. People think this is very sophisticated, but it is not. Just to see if he can respond to pain while he was breathing on his own. Throughout the duration of his hospital stay, he was responding to pain, at which time they put him on a ventilator. This signals then, and it's federally mandated by the Federal Register, 1998, that the hospitals must comply and they must contact the organ procurement organization. So a call was put in. This is where the woman in the blue suit, that very sweet person that we thought was being so caring to our family. And behind the scenes, here she is. She will begin orchestrating everything to make sure that Brandon, the organ donor, was no longer Brandon, the patient. He was now going to be dehumanized, and from this point on, he would be a number. Everything that was done from that point on, intravenous lines, the saturation of his system with fluids, within 2 hours, Brandon had received over his 2 days of fluids that he would need within 2 hours.
Wow.
And this is something that would not be done if truly they were going to monitor him closely.
Right.
I can say very simply that nothing was done to protect and preserve Brandon's life. He was no longer viewed as a person, but rather just a container of very lucrative body parts.
Wow. Now, he had signed up to be an organ donor probably when he got his driver's license, or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And the irony of all of this is that we, as a family, didn't even realize he was an organ donor. The word organ donation was not used, not once. We never even heard the word until after the so-called declaration of death was made. And this declaration of death, the bedside criteria, was performed while Brandon was under the influence of a paralyzing drug. So there was absolutely no way he could respond to this. The confirmatory test to the declaration of brain death is the apnea test. When we were asked to leave the room, we were not told that this apnea test was going to be performed. It was performed twice on Brandon. And this is what I call a medical suffocation. He was not capable of taking a breath or exhaling on his own. It was impossible for him. And during this 2 minutes, and then the second was 10 minutes, this medical strangulation of not being able to breathe, it was while they would watch his pulse go down, Brandon's heart did not skip a beat.
Wow, okay.
This is the seat of our soul. This is the seat of our life. Without this heart beating, without the circulation, and without this fresh oxygen circulating throughout the body, the person would cease living. The soul would depart. Brandon was alive.
Right.
When we left that hospital, excuse me, in our state of shock, this would stay with me. This would stay with me. This had to have been the Spirit of God. This is the only way I can explain it. Why would we not believe that he was truly dead? The paperwork that we received and all the medical information that was in his medical records, Brandon would live for 20 hours. And he would undergo his temperature would be drastically lowered, and he would be filled with chemicals to preserve his vital organs. 20 hours, he lay there alone. They say that the the hearing is the last to go. From the time Brandon was in the ambulance, conscious, he was able to hear. That really has bothered us throughout the years. We've stayed in prayer continually through the last 15 years about all of this, because it is something you carry with you. Brandon was given both a pain reliever and a paralyzing drug before they started his living dissection. And the doctors would all line up one after another, those that in their particular level of expertise for his liver and his pancreas, for both of his kidneys, and lastly, his heart. And once his heart was taken, once his heart was cut out of him and lifted out of his body, truly then he was dead. Truly then it was when his soul separated from his body. And I can only say that the propaganda for organ transplantation has been phenomenal. Taxpayer-funded, I might add. But it is in that huge void of knowledge that we have lacked, that we could all follow, you know, the blind leading the blind in this. And it just must stop. That's the reason why I'm speaking out. I can do nothing excuse me, for having lost Brandon. It is gone. What Brandon endured is gone. But if I can speak out and save one more child, one more person from being executed, and this is, you know, this was a planned, a timed death of convenience. Brandon was declared brain dead due to the fact that they had already had his organs sold. They were pre-sold. They were lining up all of the recipients. The surgical procedure was being timed. This was very well orchestrated. Absolutely every detail was orchestrated. And it was just so horrible to have lost our son and then to find out that he truly was alive. And where there is life, there is hope. There's always hope. So it is just my hope and it is my prayer that people hear this truth and come to the knowledge and understanding of how this all came about, the laws that have been set into place. And, you know, may God just carry this message. That's my prayer.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that story. I'm sorry. I just, this is such a horrendous, it is such a horrendous story, and it has happened thousands upon thousands of times to people who did not know that when they were doing this allegedly humane act, that they were really signing their own death certificate.
Absolutely. And Brandon had no idea when he was 16 years old what he was signing.
Of course not.
It was a legal document.
Of course. And yes. They have been recruiting organ donors on Facebook. They recruit them wherever they can. There's laws in, I believe, just about all the states regarding this. And let's have Dr. Byrne talk about brain death and how this all came about, started at Harvard. And it's just
yes.
Something so unbelievable that nobody would believe, nobody even considers this. So anyway, Dr. Byrne, tell us about how this all started.
To continue on with about Brandon. Brandon was alive. Brandon was living the entire time until they dissected him alive, and so they persuaded for Bernice and her family to go home after just a few hours after the injury. And then, as Bernice has clearly pointed out, while they were sent home at approximately midnight, they did not take Brandon's organs until 5 o'clock the next afternoon. So during that entire time, Brandon was at the hospital by himself, without his parents, without the pastor, without prayers going on at his bedside, without people trying to get him well, because what they were doing was keeping his organs in good shape. And the 15 hours or longer was not simply doing something for Brandon. What it was finding and lining up the ones that we're going to give the organs to. So to keep Brandon alive until they could, for the benefit of the ones they're giving the organs to. And this is a terrible time. And Bernice mentioned the breathing machine. The breathing machine, the ventilator, is a piece of equipment that we use that works only in the living person. For the breathing machine to work, the lungs and the chest have to be able to be expanded. And then when they're expanded, they retain that energy, the elastic properties that makes the air go out. And in order for that to work, the lungs have to be healthy and living, and the heart has to be beating with circulation, and then the breathing machine can work. The breathing machine cannot work in a cadaver. It has to be a living person. So, and that has been true ever since ventilators were invented, and it was true when they started to do this organ transplant venture. They cut hearts out after people were dead, but it didn't work. And so then the first heart transplant was done in South Africa on December the 1st, 1967. That became well known all over the world. But the second heart transplant was done 3 days later in Brooklyn, New York, where they cut the beating heart out of a three-day-old baby and transplanted it into an 18-day-old baby. And the way they made that determination is that the three-day-old baby had mental retardation and the 18-day-old baby was not known to have mental retardation, and someone deemed that the 18-day-old baby was more entitled to the beating heart of the 3-day-old baby, and they cut it out and transplanted it. At the end of that time, both babies were dead. So they killed both babies in attempting this heart transplant. They did this in December of 1967. And so in 1968, in order to get beating hearts for transplantation, they set up a committee at Harvard. 13 people got together, and they invented brain death. They said when somebody was unconscious and in a coma and on a ventilator, and they didn't have reflexes, they could determine that they were in an irreversible coma. They called it irreversible coma. And then they changed it to brain death after they had it established. But they did this not based on any kind of science. It was just a group of people in a room inventing, making up brain death. And so that became known as the Harvard criteria. And it really has nothing to do with Harvard other than it was a committee that met at Harvard and invented this thing. And because they had already done a heart transplant in South Africa and already done a heart transplant in the United States, and in the United States it was illegal, it was immoral in all countries to do that. And so what they did is they made up brain death so that it would be moral to cut beating hearts out. And then they embarked on making it legal. So 68, they invented brain death. In 1970, Kansas was the first state to get a law. And now all states have a law that makes it legal to cut out beating hearts and all other organs, and all of the donors have a beating heart, circulation, respiration. They're all living. Every donor is living. Every organ that's transplanted is a healthy organ, and it's taken from a living person. And when it's the heart that's cut out, or when it's the whole liver that is cut out, the living person is killed in the process. And this is a part of the transplant industry, which is operated by the federal government. The federal government sets up things like the organ procurement organizations for getting organs. They do it under the guise of protecting people, and then they sell it, they advertise it on the television, on the radio, every place you turn to become an organ donor. You go to get a driver's license, and they ask you, do you wish to be an organ donor? And if you say yes, that gets recorded. If you say no, that does not get recorded. There's nothing you can do to protect yourself. And then at the License Bureau, they ask you another question. Do you have a living will? And which is a part of an advanced directive. And living wills and advanced directives are all part of advanced telling people that you want to be an organ donor. And all of this, living wills have nothing to do with living. In some ways, they're similar to life insurance. Life insurance has nothing to do with life. It only has to do with death. Living wills have nothing to do with living. They have something to do with protecting doctors and hospitals against liability if you become dead in a hospital. There's no way to get an organ for transplantation unless it's a healthy organ that's taken from a living person. In order to stay alive on Earth, we have to have breathing. We have to have circulation. And the living person is a living person from the hair on top of our head to all the way down to our toenails. And in between, everything is part of being alive. And yes, some organs are more important to staying alive, of which the heart is a very important organ. And yes, the brain is an important organ. But when somebody is unconscious and they can't take a breath in on their own, that doesn't mean that they're dead. And when they're on a ventilator, the ventilator works only in the living person. It cannot work in a cadaver. And my own self, I started to study this subject because of a baby in 1975. Joseph was in our nursery. He had flat brain waves and was said to be brain dead, and it was suggested to stop treating him. For whatever reason, I continued to treat him. Joseph was able to be weaned from the ventilator. He did go to school. His grades were excellent. He ran track. He played baseball. He's married, has three children. So 1975, of course, I didn't know in 1975 what was going to happen with Joseph. I just knew that I should keep treating him. But then I began to study. And study and read and investigated the issue, and I said nothing publicly for at least 2 years until I understood the language of brain death. The language of brain death is one lie after another. There's nothing that's truthful about brain death. And when I first began to study it, the neurologists who were supportive of brain death said, "Oh, Paul, don't pay any attention to it because it doesn't apply to infants and children anyway." And at that time, they did not apply brain death to children and infants. Now they apply it to everybody at every age. But it did not apply then. And why didn't it apply? Because infants and children have parents that they have to deal with. And so they were slower in adopting this to infants and children, but now it has gone to every age and stage that they can get organs. In order to be brain dead, you must be alive. If someone is dead at the scene of an accident, there are no organs that you can transplant from those people. people that are cadaver truly dead, there are no organs that can be transplanted. There are some tissues, and the cornea, just the front part of the eye, is a tissue, and like skin, tendons, those are tissues. They're not organs for transplantation. Organs for transplantation have to be healthy, and organs without circulation in a matter of minutes are so damaged that you can't transplant them. The heart, within 3 to 5 minutes without circulation, is so damaged that you can't transplant it. The kidneys have a little longer time until the damage is so severe, maybe about 30 minutes. And they have to get to these organs quickly, and then they do cool them, which prolongs a period of time until they can transplant them into someone else. But they have to be healthy organs for transplantation. And where do you get healthy organs? You get them from living persons. Can you get healthy organs from a cadaver? No. And there are no organs that can be transplanted from a cadaver. Well, it's not easy to find these things out like I've done, and to find out how the medical profession gave away their superior power of investigation and finding new things. They just gave it away. The way that we ordinarily develop things in medicine, it gets done in a laboratory, sometimes a biochemistry laboratory. Sometimes it gets done with using animals, dogs or cats or rats or animals, and make advances that way. And the last thing that happens is something new gets done to persons, and under very restricted things, because things are done to protect the patient. All of that was just discarded in the invention of brain death. They didn't do any studies on dogs or cats or rats. They didn't even do any investigation on human persons. They just invented brain death and published it in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1968, and it was called A Definition of Irreversible Coma, and they translated coma into death and embarked on their way. And as serious as that first thing was, no basic science studies, no animal studies, no studies on human persons. The second article that was published was known as the Minnesota criteria. They studied only 9 patients. 2 of the 9 still had brainwave activity, and then their conclusion was: no longer is it necessary to require investigation of brainwaves before you declare somebody brain dead. And with that, the requirement for doing brainwave testing was just discarded. That happened in 1971, and just on a few patients. That's not how advances in medicine are made, and it goes on from there. The largest study in the literature was about 500 patients. Well, 44 of them didn't die, and then those that did die, 10% had nothing wrong with the brain. This is not how advances are made, and here we are now with Brandon and Bernice telling us how Brandon had drugs to depress him, and how he was responding, and still they did things to hurry up his death because he was a healthy, energetic young man who had organs that were going to be useful for someone else who was not in a coma like he was, or not injured like he was. And then it goes on all the time. And the people that listen to this program, those that have been exposed to this in their own experience, they can verify that something very similar happened to their loved one also.
Thank you so much. I think, too, that a lot of people may never actually go through the medical records like Bernice did. I think that a lot of people would just be so devastated, as she was, as her family was. But I think that there was something, I think that you were kind of inspired to look deeply into what had happened. And I think that's how this all came about. And then I think it's interesting that you, Dr. Byrne, and Bernice have found each other and can share this story. Because honestly, you are there are a couple of other people that talk about this. And for that, I'm very grateful for their comments and contributions to this. But honestly, people really do believe that when they sign the donor card, that they have to be dead in order to be an organ donor. They think that after they die, that someone will come in and take all those organs, and they feel like they're doing something. They're giving back. Their death has enabled them to give back something of value. And that is why I think 99.9% of the people who sign up to be organ donors believe that. And in fact, the consensus of the herd mentality in America believes that. That is what they believe. And yet that is not the case. Now, the doctors that perform this, that do the organ transplants, they know exactly what they are doing, correct?
Absolutely. When Brandon, to stay focused on Brandon, when they took his organs, they make an incision from the neck all the way down to the pubis, and they cut through the sternum, use a saw, cut through the sternum, and spread open the chest, spread open the abdomen. And when the transplant surgeon gets in there, he saw Brandon's beating heart. He saw it beating very regularly, very strongly. That does not happen in a cadaver. He knew, and the transplant surgeons all know that these donors are all very much alive, because after death, when there is no circulation, there is no respiration, there are essentially no organs that can be transplanted. So they're aware of what they're doing, and as you mentioned, the general public is not informed. Well, the transplant surgeons are informed, but they have something somehow or another that they rationalize that it's all right to do this because of something good that will happen to someone else. Well, that's contrary to the way that I learned medicine, and it's contrary to medicine in general, that when a patient comes to us for help, they expect us to take care of them, not some other patient. And so it's important that we concentrate on the person and that we're taking care of, and it's always a person and a living person. Once somebody is a cadaver, it's the remains of someone, and doctors have nothing to do with cadavers. They go to undertakers and other places. A doctor takes care of living persons. Nurses take care of living persons, not cadavers. That's for the undertaker and the funeral home people. But not doctors or nurses.
Okay, now, talking about brain death. Brain death your brain has to be working in order for your heart to beat and all the other things.
Hang on. That is a misconception.
Okay.
The beating of the heart is intrinsic to the heart. And by that it means that it beats on its own. The origin of the heartbeat is in the heart itself. The brain does not make the heart beat. The brain can participate in a certain finesse in the heart. For instance, if we would take a breath in, the heart would be at and just hold it while it's in, the heart would beat at a certain rate. If we breathe out, the heart rate would change. Well, in ordinary, like when we're talking to each other and we're breathing, our heartbeat is regular if we feel our pulse, but it's an irregularity that varies on a number of things, like how and the brain does help to coordinate that. But when the brain is not part of the beating of the heart, then the heart beats very regularly and will continue to be on its own. The beating of the heart is intrinsic to the heart. It does not need the brain to be.
Okay. All right. Somebody asked me if someone was to be beheaded, would the heart continue to beat? And I thought, well, probably not. But is that the case?
Well, beheading is certainly different from anything that has to do with just an absence of the functioning of the brain, in the sense that when someone is beheaded, the major blood vessels are cut across and the blood is lost quickly, and then there's no way to breathe, so that the system of the body that has to do with getting oxygen is cut off, and also the brain and the nervous system is cut off. The beheading is a cutting off or a stopping of at least those three major systems of the body. So it's a different kind of thing than what happens with the absence of functioning of the brain.
Okay. All righty. Now, the brain death, Brandon was cognizant in the ambulance going to the hospital. Now, was he taken to a hospital or a trauma center? And what is the difference? Trauma center. There's a difference, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there is. And that's what, and in all honesty, I'm the one that demanded that he go there. I had always been taught that a trauma center could facilitate those with traumatic injury, whether they be their head or, you know, an emergency surgery, that all of those had been highly trained and were ready to cope with such, severe injuries.
Sure.
And I'm actually the one who diverted where he would have gone in the first place. And I carried that around in my bucket of that I held against myself, being unknowledgeable. But
you can't.
Truly,
you cannot.
Well,
do that.
No, I can't, and I have let that go because of the fact that, you know, having to study, having to really dig deeply into this, having to understand that Brandon was like one of the first, I should say, this law, the Federal Register, mandating all hospitals to comply with the Organ Procurement Organization. That, you know, it would have made any difference. Absolutely not. Brandon was an organ donor. And if they could not have facilitated him in one hospital, they would have simply transported him to another. But all of this would take a while. And I do believe that there is if we have faith, then we must have reason. You know, and this is what I believe that we have lost a lot of, that why haven't we questioned this? Why didn't our family prior to Brandon's horrific death, why didn't we question more about this brain death? You know, we didn't, in all honesty, even think about it. You're right, the altruism. And having to, having gone into the church, having, I had a pastor one time tell me that it was early in the 80s, that they were asked by the Oregon Procurement Organization to be able to come in and offer some sessions. Anybody who wanted to stay, they could come and hear about organ donation and how wonderful it is. Well, I just don't think that any level of education has not been touched by this. And we have this vast, you know, void of knowledge has been filled with all of this baloney, and that's all
yes.
it is. And so we were, you know, in the name of altruism, helping somebody else, like you said, when they are dead. I do want to elaborate a little bit on what Dr. Burns said, because from, you know, Brandon did not give consent. Neither did we give consent to any of the things that went on behind closed doors. This is, you know, a huge, and this should be raised up, so to speak. And people must understand that you have to be knowledgeable before you go into any procedure. Any procedure,
right.
Any surgical procedure has risk, and a good doctor, one who protects and preserves his patient, is going to perform a procedure to protect and preserve his patient's life. And they are very open about the surgical procedure and the risks. And obviously, the risk has to outweigh, you know,
or the
good
benefit
has to outweigh,
has to
the,
outweigh
risk.
The risk.
Exactly. And if you just think about this with organ donation and how this has all been formulated, I'll use that word, that we are to be deceived, and exactly what is laid out before the organ donor is to do harm. It is to take their life. And it absolutely boggles the minds of people that this is truly taking place. They are actually shocked that this is really what is happening. Something else I want to state is that the reason why informed consent is an issue with me, many times I have just been confronted with this, with hostility. Well, your family consented to this. No, we did not, nor did Brandon. None of us consented to this. Well, don't you feel good that he was giving a paralyzing drug and an anesthetic? At least he didn't feel any pain, did he? Well, I want to make this very, very clear. Yes, while Brandon was alleviated some of the pain to have it go through a living dissection, this isn't the real reason why it's done. This is done for those who are in the surgical arena, the theater. Let's not cause them any distress. We can't have people moving about and screaming out in pain now, can we? And when it is known that when that scalpel is inserted into those that are even comatose, they awake. And so that's one aspect of it. Secondly, when you are in trauma, you are suffering such great pain. This is transmitted from the brain to the source of the pain, back to the brain, so it causes a horrible distress in the patient. And it decreases oxygen level in the person because they are experiencing this horrible pain. It is the focus and the intent to make sure that those organs, each and every one of them, are saturated with fresh oxygen. And this is first and foremost. Brandon's well-being was not at the heart or the mind of any of these people. And so I just wanted to touch on that because it's not really talked about. And to know that Brandon heard. You know, I want people to understand that while we're in there telling Brandon goodbye, he could hear us. That has gone with me. Brandon, you know, like I've said, Brandon laid there in preparation to undergo this human sacrifice. They were going to sacrifice Brandon's life for another. and he would hear everything. Now, can I say with absolute assurity? Well, as a mother, this is one of the reasons why I sought to learn all that I can. You know, there's something about being somebody's mother, a child's mother. There's something to be said greatly about that, that I would never leave Brandon. And to this day, he is so close to me. Thankfully, I have Christ. Thankfully, I have the truth and knowing that he is safe in heaven. But there is that love that surpasses this earth and lives on. And it is that great love that sought for justice. And it cannot be separated. Love is justice. That cannot be separated. And it's for this reason I speak out. I speak out for all those mothers and those fathers who so love their child. And Deanna, this new propaganda machine that they have going, you know,
oh,
they're hot
yes.
for my body. I do want to
yes.
touch on this.
Please
it,
do.
It should be noted that in this, it states, wherever your age or your medical history may be, let the medical profession determine the time of your death if you would be an eligible donor. Don't make that decision or rule yourself out just because that you're too old or not healthy enough. That really bothers me. This must be our decision with knowledge to say, no, I'm not going to be an organ donor, and to make sure that our refusal is in writing. And according to the Revised Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, unless it is, you have no voice. And to want to perpetuate this, and this is what they have to do, they will fill this vast void of knowledge with this propaganda. It's got to stop. It must stop. So that's the end of my sermon. Sorry.
That's okay. Now, you have the Life Guardian Foundation has a booklet that is available to anyone. In fact, please, listeners, visit the website, and that website again is lifeguardianfoundation.org, www.lifeguardianfoundation.org. There is a booklet that you can get. You can get the medical cards that you should carry with you at all times, because according to the law in every state, you even if you didn't sign up to be an organ donor, unless you say that you do not want to be an organ donor, it's presumed that you do. Now, the hospitals make more money by donating, extracting your organs than they do in saving your life. Isn't that correct?
Well, put it this way. They make money with, you know, the utilization of the patient as an organ donor. It costs them money to protect and prevent.
The organ transplantation industry is a very large industry, one of the largest ones, but they're completely dependent on getting your healthy organs for transplantation. That's the only way they have the business, and the business is run by the government, but the federal government has ways of marketing or setting this out with different kinds of organizations that they pretend like they don't have anything to do with it. They even have their own government Institute of Medicine, which is appointed. It doesn't have anything to do with specialty in cardiac disease or specialty in neurological disease. It has to do with an appointed group of people, some of whom are doctors, and it's called the Institute of Medicine. And the Institute of Medicine is decides these things about who's a candidate for having their organs taken, decides many other things too that have to do with Medicare and Medicaid. Most people have no idea about what's happening, and maybe even most medical people have no idea about what's happening. So far as brain death is concerned, what that means is that the patient is alive. Everybody who's called brain dead is alive. If they were dead, they just call them dead. But this brain death means that they have beating heart, circulation, and respiration. If they cut into them without a paralyzing agent, many of them move and that kind of thing. And so, but in this area of brain death, in order to get more organs, they invented what they call cardiac death. And in cardiac death, they have a functioning brain. But what they do in cardiac death is they take away the breathing support and other kinds of support for them. They take away, and then they observe as to how long it until they're without a pulse, not without a heartbeat, but without a pulse. What that means is that the heart is not big enough, is not strong enough to cause a pulse. How long do they have to be without a pulse? In the New England Journal of Medicine a few years ago, two babies in Colorado were without a pulse for 75 seconds. That is 1 minute and 15 seconds. And that was considered sufficient to declare them dead. And while they still had a beating heart, but not strong enough to cause a pulse, then they proceeded to cut their beating hearts out and transplant them into other babies. Now, some places will extend that time out to 2 minutes, or maybe 5 minutes, but medicine knows that if someone is without a pulse for 5 minutes, they can be resuscitated, and it happens all the time. Yet these people are not resuscitated, but after the 75 seconds or the 2 minutes or the 5 minutes without a pulse, that's considered to be sufficient for the declaration of brain death, and then, I'm sorry, the declaration of heart death, and then they proceed to do things to cut their organs out to give them to other people. These are, those that are called heart death, those that are called brain death, those are all living persons, and it's legal, as Deanna pointed out. The laws are such to make them declared brain dead, or heart dead, but also, even without any of that, 47 states have already passed a law that it presumes that you intend to be an organ donor, and it's presumed that you've consented to every test to determine if your organs were good for someone else, would be good for someone else, and yet you presume that you consented to have everything done to you to keep your organs in good shape for someone else. And, of course, presumed consent is no consent. And people are not informed. They go to the License Bureau. And why is the License Bureau interested in whether you have a living will? Why is the License Bureau interested in you're having an accident so they can get your organs for transplantation? I don't understand this. What's wrong with the people? Why don't you say to the License Bureau, you should be interested in whether I can drive the car, whether I can see, whether I can hear is what you should be interested in, not in whether I've signed up to give my organs to someone else, that's a so-called living will, not in whether I want my organs for someone else. That's not what a License Bureau should be doing. And yet these are the laws. And we keep parading in to License Bureau, and we keep answering these questions. When are we going to think? When are we going to do things these things don't make any sense, but it's done under the guise of doing something good. but it's good for someone else, and the government is operating it. The United States government has this big organ transplantation business, and it's throughout the country. And yes, Bernice and her family suffered. So do many other families. You mentioned, Deanna, about speaking up and trying to do something. We also have experience with other families that try to do something, but it isn't just the medical profession that's involved with this. The legal profession is involved also. And then once they get involved with the laws are set up to get your organs. And then even if you find a lawyer that at the beginning will seem to be understanding as to what it is that you're talking about, by the time the lawyers get to talking to the other lawyers, they come to some, as they call it, negotiation. But it's agreement to go along with this non-protection of the person, that is to get their organs, and then things get settled. Very seldom, and maybe never, have they ever gone to court over these matters, at least so far as doing damage to another person. And so the court system is all involved in this. The medical system's involved in this. A good example along that is the Jahi McBath in California. You know, 13-year-old girl who went to the hospital to have her tonsils removed, and in the course of that, she was declared brain dead. And they asked her mother for organs, and her mother said, no, my Jahi is alive. And they said, well, all right, if we can't take your organs, then we're going to take away her life support. And her mother said, "What? No, you can't do that. She's alive. She's my Jahi. You can't be doing things to harm her." And so then that goes to court, and death certificate gets issued on Jahi December the 12th of 2013. And here we are at the end of September. Jahi is still very much alive. Her heart has been beating all the time, continues to beat. She has respiration. Yes, the breathing machine does help her, but she's digesting and absorbing her food. She has bowel movements like all other living persons. She passes urine. She doesn't have a catheter. She's very much alive and has been alive all the time. Yet if Jahi's mother would have succumbed to the question of saying yes to taking her organs, Jahi's organs would have been distributed throughout the world in someone else, but they're still with Jahi. Jahi is still very much alive, but the reason she's alive is because of God, who says, yes, Jahi, continue to live, and her mother, who did like a mother and stood up for her Jahi, and so Jahi continues to live. You haven't heard the end of the story of Jahi, and I can't tell you how long Jahi will live, but I can't tell you how long Deanna or Bernice or myself are going to live. I can't tell you that, but I can tell you that Deanna's alive and Bernice is alive and I'm alive and Jahi is alive. How long we'll live, I can't tell you, but I can tell you that we're alive. And we're not alive simply because we're talking. We are alive because the life is inside of us, and it's in all parts of us. And we all know the difference between life and death. And to say someone is dead while their heart is beating and they're having circulation and respiration, even if it's supported by medical means, that doesn't mean that that person is dead. We know the difference between life and death, and Jehiah is alive, and we know that Bernice's son, Brandon, was alive, and other donors, they're alive until they cut them open and cutting out the organs, and it's the cutting out of the organs that makes them become dead in the process. And these things are not so difficult to understand, but you're kept from hearing what we're talking about. You're not allowed to hear this, because if you hear it, you're going to mess up the big organ transplantation industry. It's not easy for us to be exposing these things either, because as a physician, I care about the medical profession. I'm a citizen. Bernice is a citizen. Deanna, you're citizens of the United States. We live here. We know the great things about our country, but we also know that there's ways that are things that are going on that make us make our organs more valuable than ourselves, and that's the way the laws are written.
Wow. Now you said that. Okay. Let's go back to Brandon. They gave him all these fluids within 2 hours. Was that what was that for? And inasmuch as he was conscious during the ambulance ride, what would a physician, what should a physician have done to treat Brandon instead of preparing him for harvesting?
First of all, what you do is you give the right amount of fluids. The fluids that are given in those large quantities are to make sure that the liver and the kidneys are perfused, that the circulation stays to them so that they stay healthy, even at the risk of doing something like overloading the circulation. And this is common. It's very difficult to get records to review because they seal them. They won't let you get the records. But when in the course of these things, I've been able to get a hold of hospital records that other people might not get. But in looking at them in a way to evaluate what went on, and it's common they in a few hours, they'll get the amount of fluids that they would get over 2 or 3 days, and it's to keep the kidneys in good shape and the liver in good shape till they can get someone else to give it to. So far as sedating them and doing things, it can be done in a way to help them to stay alive, but it's done in a way to keep them so they don't move, so they can intubate them. As Brandon, they couldn't, when they tried to intubate and put the tube in his throat, he resisted. So then they tried again, he resisted again. And so when he resisted so much, then they paralyzed him so they could do what they wanted to do. Very quickly, when they saw this strong young man, it was to get his organs, and everything went in the direction of getting his organs. Yes, he did get an operation on his head, but it really was not an operation to help his brain. It was an operation to maybe show to Brandon's father that they were doing something, but it really wasn't something to help him to live. Move things along so they could get declare him brain dead and get the parents and the relatives out of there so they could do their things to keep his organs in good shape for someone else.
Now,
well, I'd like to insert this too, that
ahead.
Mannitol is a drug that is given to reduce the the swelling in the brain. And this, and if they were going to help Brandon, this would be, you know, I would say common. You can ask Dr. Byrne if that's a good word that I could use, that in a traumatic head injury. It's notable that it wasn't until after the declaration of death that they even started treating Brandon. His treatment was better. He did receive mannitol after the declaration of death. So here they are with a full understanding of exactly what they are doing. They're treating Brandon now better. They want
so they,
to
they
protect
did the
and
declaration.
Preserve his life.
Mm-hmm. They did the declaration at what point in time?
Based on after the surgery.
Okay.
They did the bedside criteria evaluation for brain death, and that was the five steps. Then to, in support of, or for as confirmatory, they would do the apnea test. And after which time, it is noted in his records by the organ procurement agent that he would be given preservation drugs immediately. The protocol is set in rapid succession, she writes. But now they're treating him for the his ICP, his intracranial pressure. And
Which they should have done immediately, right?
It should have done immediately. Yes, they would have carefully monitored the amount of fluids that they were given to not induce his intracranial pressure in his brain. But this was not their intent. And something else I want to make clear is that all of us parents who have been in these traumatic situations, all of us who have been made the request of our loved one to be an organ donor, whether you say yes or no, we have been literally like rats in cages for years. How we respond, how we react, what makes our decision, how do we come upon what works and what doesn't work? That has been the base for the training behind the scenes. They call it the huddle. And to make sure that everyone, the staff in the hospital, and the doctors, and nurses, and even the clergy, are on the same page to huddle, to make sure that they get permission. They don't really want to offend people with any big fights about organ donation.
Now, they have agents in every hospital. Organ procurement organizations have an agent in every single hospital, correct?
No, only when they have trained people ready to deal with the organ donor. They have the organ procurement agent called in upon the time that the ventilator is administered.
In the hospital, they're called designated requesters. Mm-hmm. That is, they've been trained as to how to approach the relatives make sure that relatives realize now is to make sure relatives realize it doesn't do any good even if you object, because the organ donor card has been signed as indicated not, you know, a few weeks ago. When the relatives objected, the organ procurement people went to court and got the court to say yes, they could take the organs, even though the relatives were objecting. That was a 24-year-old young man that anybody can look it up and find out what's going on. And it's such that it's everything is set up to get organs. It isn't set up to protect and preserve your life. The idea is to get organs for someone else.
Now, they look for accident victims, right? Accident victims make good donors, and you don't have to be. Now, Brandon was young. But you can be any age and they can extract your organs, correct?
Yes.
Right. The people who are the most healthy are the ones that they focus on. The most healthy people are between 16 and 40. And if you're between 16 and 40 and you're unconscious and on a ventilator, the odds are that they're going to get your organs. But they will take organs. The latest article that I saw said that they were willing to accept donors up to the age of 75. They keep expanding this out from 40 to 50 to 60. And the latest thing I saw was 75. And of course, what sometimes if they can't or don't use the organs, they do experimentation on people who are older and not so useful for having healthy organs. And it's very difficult to get a handle on these things, but there are articles in the literature that verify that these things are so. But the basic principle in medicine ought to be to protect and preserve the life of the person, and doctors ought not ever hasten death. That's wrong. Doctors ought not harm a patient in any way. Ought is a special word because it's rooted in the word owe, you know, to owe somebody. So it's ought. A doctor owes to his patient. The patients are vulnerable, susceptible. But when a patient comes to us comes to me as a physician, they expect that I'm going to just help them. And I owe that to them. That's what a physician is. That physicians do not harm, do not hasten death, do not make people become dead. And every time that a heart transplant is done, it's a beating heart that's cut out of somebody who is alive. Granted, they have something wrong with them, or they wouldn't be in the hospital or the intensive care unit, but they're not dead. And so doctors ought to protect and preserve life, parents love their children, we should be loving and caring about each other so that we don't do things to harm others or to harm ourselves, that we should be protecting and preserve our life. And actually, that's the way that I learned medicine, this thing of not respecting life so much became much worse in about 1968 when they invented this thing called brain death. There were other things going on also at that time, I learned medicine how to protect and preserve life and not to harm and not to kill.
You said that this was operated by the federal government, and you mentioned the Institute of Medicine. What agency conceived of this initially? When did the federal government enter the picture to become to be in this business?
It was after brain death was invented. I don't know the year offhand that the Institute of Medicine began, but when the Institute of Medicine began, for instance, myself, I was a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics. For the surgeons, there's for the internal medicine. We have professional organizations. And those professional organizations could have easily helped the federal government, but the federal government appointed their own Institute of Medicine so that they control who they put into their advisory committee. The Institute of Medicine is the one that advises the Secretary of Health, and then the Secretary of Health determines how Medicare, and now it's spread out to Medicaid, how these things happen. And then it's set up in organ transplantation that the that what the Secretary of Health recommends is what happens, and then the Joint Commission comes along and makes sure that it does happen. Like the Joint Commission, it reviews hospitals and they make sure that they have a policy for heart death. And you have to have this, and if you don't have the approval, then you don't get Medicare and Medicaid funding. And these things are all built into the system to make it happen. And the government is the one that's behind this and is making it happen. But for whatever reason, people are busy or not paying attention or whatever it is. But to be for the heart death, all it takes is someone to have a head injury and on a ventilator, and that's the signal to call the organ procurement organization that they can be an organ donor. And then in brain death, they all have a functioning brain, and they have evidence of a functioning brain, but they still want their organs. And so then what they do is they go to the relatives and get a do not resuscitate order. And then once they have the do not resuscitate order, then they take away the ventilator, and then they have a score that they have put together. It's called a Wisconsin score, and the Wisconsin score is used to predict that when they take away the ventilator again, they'll be without a pulse within 60 minutes, that's 1 hour, or within 120 minutes, that's 2 hours. So it's a prediction that they'll be without a pulse. And all of this is set into place. And sometimes it starts right at the scene of the accident. And that might have even happened in the case of Brandon, that right at the scene at their home, while Bernice knows whatever she knows about deciding which hospital to go to, the paramedics could have had some other kind of conversation as to which hospital to go to. And trauma centers were mentioned. Every hospital is declared a trauma center, but it's a level one, level two, or level three trauma centers. And it's the level one trauma centers that are also the transplant centers. You think you're going to the level one trauma center to get the best care, and you might, but also the level one trauma center is the centers where they get your organs. My wife and son were in a severe automobile accident, and I was grateful that my wife went to a level two trauma center because I knew they wouldn't get her organs there. If she'd gone to a level one trauma center, I would have had to deal with one other thing about how not to let them have her organs. And there are these things that are built into the system. Most people are not paying any attention. Why do I pay attention? I paid attention because of baby Joseph in 1975, and then I investigated and then wrote articles in the Journal of the American Medical Association. I have an article in the Gonzaga Law Review. It's 85 pages and has 244 footnotes to it. I investigated from a medical point of view, a way a medical investigator investigates things, and then wrote that way. It's only in more recent times that I do things like radio programs and other things to help educate the general public as to what's going on. But in the beginning, I did it in a very academic way and have articles to support what I say in the academic literature. But now I'm grateful to you, Deanna, for having Bernice and I on the program. I'm grateful for Bernice to speak up. The many people that go through the traumatic things that Bernice and her family went through, many people are living with it, letting it go, whatever it is. Some have tried to do something legally, but it doesn't work. There's a lady in Oklahoma that her daughter was in Colorado and injured in an automobile accident. Her daughter essentially got no medical treatment because they wanted her organs. And when her mother wouldn't say yes to her organs, yes, it was several days that she was there until she died, but she was without any kind of good medical treatment to help her to live. And so people suffer. They suffer for the rest of their life. What do they do? Bernice is doing what she can do. And yes, if there are other people out there that have similar situations, please get in touch with us. And then encourage people to go to our website, lifeguardianfoundation.org. And we have booklets that we send out that you request. We also have the cards that you mentioned, Deanna, the card that you can carry with you to protect and preserve your life. And you can designate someone to protect and preserve your life. And these cards and what we recommend is a power of attorney that will protect and preserve your life. But these cards only designate someone to protect and preserve your life, not hasten your death and not shorten your life. And they all say do not do an apnea test. The apnea test is not a test for sleep apnea. The apnea test is a test where the medical people take away the breathing apparatus for up to 10 minutes. Up to 10 minutes without a breath, and that makes the carbon dioxide in the body increase. It makes them get acidotic. It makes their brain swelling get worse, and no one should have an apnea test. And you need to know, no to an apnea test. That's not a sleep apnea test. That's a different thing. Sleep apnea test is okay, but not an apnea test. And then the other thing that the card says is do not take any organ for transplantation. And people need to carry these cards, have them with them. It's the only way because the state laws, even if the state laws say that you can refuse to be an organ donor, no state law gives you a mechanism for refusing to be an organ donor. It only is set up to get your organs, and if you say no, that's not recorded in any state, and you have to have a document of refusal, and that's what these cards do, and carry it with you. It's your chance to protect your life, and while it's your life, whoever you are that's listening, it's the lives especially of the people who are between 16 and 40. Recently I went to New Jersey to see a lady, 40 years old, who was in an automobile accident, and her husband did not want them to carry out these things about brain death and that. And not only was he not able to be effective, they wouldn't give us any records to even look at. We had to go to court to get the records. And when I asked the nurse, what is her temperature? His response was, oh, we can't tell you that. So these things are all being right. There I was, a doctor. Granted, I was not a treating doctor, but at the bedside and could not even get a simple question like that answered. And I was there with the lady's husband, could not get a simple answer. We were there with an attorney. We had to go to court to get any information because the whole goal and objective was to carry out their thing about brain death, of which they primarily wanted her organs since she had healthy organs. But in any event, and I don't mean to point out any particular state or any particular hospital. It's essentially the same all over. There is a difference whether you're in a large city hospital or a rural hospital. Your chances of having your life protected statistically is better in a rural hospital than it is in the city hospital where they can get your organs.
Right. Now, we also want to be resuscitated, don't we?
Yes, you should be resuscitated. Don't worry, you won't get too much treatment. But you should say that you want to be resuscitated, because the way it's written, if you put a document like a living will or something says under certain circumstances you don't want to get some kind of treatment, whatever that is, be resuscitated or antibiotics or fluids or whatever it is, and then if you die, your relatives don't have a leg to stand on to raise any kind of objection, because you've already said that under certain conditions you want to die.
Wow.
And what you should be wanting to do is to live. You want to live the length of time that God gives you, and you don't want anybody to shorten your life and nobody to hasten your death. And don't worry, you won't get too much treatment, and don't worry, you won't live too long. But you will have a chance to get treated, and other people will be able to stand by your bedside and say, yes, I love my mother, I love my father, I love my wife, I love my husband, and you'll be able to have someone stand up for you. But if you've already signed a document that says under certain conditions you'd rather not get treated and you want to get off the earth, all you've done is protected the doctors in the hospital if you got less treatment than what you were really entitled to.
Right. Now, you, I looked up the Institute of Medicine was chartered in 1970. So that's pretty significant to my mind, because
you know,
it was right.
Now that you bring that to the attention about 1970, what's significant there is 1968 is the Harvard criteria, and also what's significant there is the Anatomical Gift Act was propagated in 1968 also, and that's the one that they used to get organs. They revised it in 2006, revised it to spread it out and make it easier to get organs. But all of this started around 1968, 1970. Kansas was the first state to legalize brain death in 1970.
Wow.
Yes, Institute of Medicine, 1970, when it got started. And again, in 1970, you did not need to have an Institute of Medicine to find out about neurological diseases. You had the American Academy of Neurology. You didn't need it for orthopedics. You had the American Academy of Orthopedics, American Academy of Pediatrics. You had all of these academic organizations that were specialty organizations. They existed, and it could have easily been brought together. But at that time, it was much more difficult to control doctors. Now doctors are controlled because doctors are being hired by hospitals, because they can control the hospital as to whether you get treatment or don't get treatment, and then the doctors are hired by the hospital, so they'll have to do what their employer tells them to do, and it's much easier to control now than it was back in 1968, when doctors were still independent and working for their patients, and so many things have changed now.
Well, a lot of medical groups are now associated with a hospital. They have privileges just to one hospital or maybe two hospitals, and so they have a standard of care that supersedes whatever they would have wanted to do with their patient. And if they want to retain hospital privileges, they have to, follow the standard of care, correct?
Right. And then when you talk about the standard of care, on my column at Renew America, I put up an article that I wrote a few years ago about Karen Ann Quinlan. Karen Ann Quinlan
oh,
is
yes.
called the... In- the index case for the Right to Die movement. And in the Karen Ann Quinlan case was the first time the law used accepted standards of practice. Before that, they used the law was reasonable standards or usual and customary standards or standards like that. But the accepted standards of medicine was first used in the Karen Ann Quinlan case, and it's the accepted standards that are used in the brain death laws. The accepted standards are the weakest of all standards. An example of that is that before you declare someone brain dead, it should be usual to do brainwave testing. It should be customary. It should be ordinary. It's reasonable to do brainwave testing to determine if there's any brainwaves before you declare someone brain dead. Yet it's acceptable to declare them brain dead without doing a brainwave test. So you see, acceptable standards, and that's what's being used, is acceptable standards, and that started in the Karen Ann Quinlan case. That was the first case that I was able to find where acceptable standards is. It's the weakest of all standards so far as the practice of medicine is concerned. And it varies. And of course, what a hospital policy is becomes the acceptable standard for that policy, for that hospital.
Wow.
Yeah, Brandon wasn't given an EEG. So, I mean, that just, you know, and Dr. Byrne, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but in my aspect, you know, looking at this, did they have to do one to know that Brandon was mentally aware? No, but you would think that this simplistic and it's non-invasive, that this would be done with every head injury, but it's not.
They don't really want to find out that there is any functioning of the brain. What they want to do is declare brain death or declare something else so that they can get organs. Yeah, while there can be people that are very sincere that are involved with all of this, sincere or not sincere, they just have to look up the literature. The Harvard criteria was published without any studies on dogs or cats or even on human persons. They just made it up. They had primarily doctors that dealt with neurology, not a cardiologist, not an internist, not a family physician. None of them were on their committee. Why not? Because the goal and objective was to find a way to make it moral to cut beating hearts out. That was the goal and objective. And they point that out when they write about it. They say, we have to have this new way to declare people dead so that we can get organs. And also they said, because if you keep people living, then intensive care units will get crowded. Well, you know what we did in infants when we figured, you know, in the beginning we had no way to treat babies. We found ways and invented intensive care units, neonatal intensive care units. I can remember the nurse saying to me, well, when I had just one ventilator, the nurse said, well, Dr. Byrne, what are you going to do if you have another patient who needs the ventilator and you have only one? I said, well, I will breathe for him until you can bring another one on board from another city or another hospital. And that's what we did when we got crowded. We built bigger units. But that's not what they did in organ transplant industry. When the intensive care units got crowded, they found a way to get them out and make them become dead. But, of course, it's much more lucrative to get their organs. And now the campaign is to do away with brain death, do away with heart death, and make it that when you're in a coma, especially if somehow or another you've designated ahead of time, you want to be an organ donor, that they can get your organs. And these kinds of things are in the literature that comes comes my way, that people are campaigning for this. In the beginning, there were not very many of us that were taking a stand about this, but there are many people now, and people writing books about what's happening. But I still don't see very many people being very concerned. They think it's somebody else's son or somebody else's problem, and they don't find out about it until they get involved with their own situation. But we encourage education ahead of time. Go look at our website, lifeguardianfoundation.org. Order a little booklet from us. We send them out. Sometimes people send us a donation, and if they do, we greatly appreciate that. But in any event, between Bernice and I, and help from people like Deanna, we keep going, and we're going to keep going, God willing, as long as we can. And we have the cards. You need to carry the card with you, and you need to designate someone to some way to protect your child. Even when you send them to grandma on vacation, if they're 10 years old and something happens to them, what grandma says will not protect their life. You need to have a power of attorney for a dependent person in order to protect their life. You need to do these things or your child's organs are going to be taken. If somebody's unconscious and on a ventilator, their organs, their life is in jeopardy.
Now, the other thing, too, is that the media does not talk about this. You also said that a lot of these cases never go to court. And I have a feeling that that lawyers don't want this to go to court, because then it will be, it'll be publicized, and then people will find out about it. And so they try and pay off the victim's family or negotiate with the victim's family in order to keep all of this quite secretive. And of course, the media never, the only thing that we hear about on the mainstream media is the encouragement to become an organ donor. We never hear about what that entails.
Right. Never do. But all the reasons that are behind that, I can't tell you. We can speculate about it, but certainly what you said about the lawyers settling things and then they don't become public matter, and there are some cases that are out there that truly this is the case, that you get a lawyer that you think is going to be on your side. That is, if you're a parent of someone, you think the lawyer is going to be on your side, only to find out that as things move along, he negotiates your powers away and you end up with no power. You end up with no way of expressing how you know that things were done to your son or your daughter that were not in the interest of your son or daughter, but were in the interest of getting organs. And so it ends up that nothing happens, or at least very little happens, and it's done so that the people don't find out. They don't want anybody to find out what's happening with this. And so you're very helpful to Deanna to let your listeners hear what's going on. And your listeners need to be concerned. They need to realize it could be them. I don't want anything bad to happen to anybody's child. But in order to... in order to take a stand for the life of your child, for the life of yourself, you need to read what we have at Life Guardian Foundation. You need to get the cards to carry with you. You need the card for every person, and you need to have the other documents that we have in there about power of attorney for your to protect your life. But it allows your wife or your husband to protect and preserve your life, not to make your life get shortened. Most of the powers of attorney that I've seen find out some way under certain circumstances your life can be shortened. We don't think that's the right way. Don't worry. You won't live a second longer than what God says yes.
Right.
And don't worry. You won't be spending too much of somebody else's money. There's too many forces to stop that from happening. All you need to do is at least express that you want to live as long as God gives you, and you want your life to be protected and preserved, and you don't want anybody to do any harm to you. You don't want anybody to shorten your life. And that's what we stand for. We're an organization that protects and preserves life from the very beginning until true death. And you have to use words like true death. Natural death doesn't cut it, because if you take somebody like Terry Schiavo, that they took away her food and water and starved her and dehydrated her to death for 13 days and caused her to be dead, some people would say, well, she had a natural death. And so natural death doesn't cut it. Death used to have meaning, and then they distorted the word death by inventing brain death. That distorted death. And then they invented heart death. That distorts death. Natural death also can be a distortion. So the only way that you can stay with the truth, you must say true death. And someone is not truly dead when their heart is beating and they have circulation and respiration. And that's what everybody has when they are called brain dead. They're all living persons.
All righty, let's talk a little bit about Medicaid, Medicare, the digitization of records, and the Affordable Care Act. I think this is all set up so that other entities will have more say-so over what you receive in the way of medical care. I think it's all being taken out of the individual's hands. And the digitization of the records, that was put in, when did they did the HIPAA law, and that was supposed to protect our privacy, when in fact it just made it easier for them to collect all this information and centralize it. Correct?
Right, you're right. The HIPAA law has 14 ways that the government can get our information without our permission, and they can use it without our permission. And one of the 14 ways is to get our organs. And then to carry that further, they have the federal government actually pays doctors to use an electronic health record. And they pay a large amount of money to the doctor to initiate the electronic health record. And then the electronic health record is so that other hospitals can and other doctors can have access, ready access to your records. But it's also so the government can get access to your records. Now, maybe it doesn't make any difference, but there are things that are in the medical records of persons that are no business of a different doctor, that are no business of the federal government, and we give so much away, and we readily accept it, whether we're an ordinary person or a doctor. You know, a doctor say, oh, you're going to pay me $14,000 to put in an electronic health record, of course I'll do it, you know, and that kind of thing. And that's going on. If you didn't have electronic health, if a doctor didn't have electronic health record, the government is there to help him to do it. And, of course, the hospitals all organized to do it, too. They have people that they pay to help the doctors to do it in hospitals. And it's all being organized, and part of all this organization is to get your organs, and so people need to be paying attention.
Okay, now you said that the government is really running the organ procurement organizations. Is there a particular agency that does this?
UNOS. UNOS is the abbreviation for it. And theoretically, it was set up to make sure that there was not differences between the wealthy and the less affluent. But actually, when you go to find out, you find out that the people without insurance are much more likely to be an organ donor. One statistic that I saw that 17% without insurance, and then the recipients, it was only like 0.8% without insurance received an organ. So there is this differentiation that's going out there, and of course we hear about how it costs so much for medical treatment and care and Medicare and that kind of thing. Medicare, when it started, was just for people over the age of 65. But then it expanded out to everybody with kidney disease, and then it expanded out to organ transplantation. The large amounts of money for organ transplantation come from Medicare, and that's part of why it doesn't have so much money, because it isn't just for people over 65. It goes to other reasons, and one of the reasons is Medicare. One man that I talked to said his daughter-in-law received a liver, and the total bill was $1.4 million. And I said, well, who paid for it? He said, well, they had health insurance, and then he contributed a large amount of money himself, and Medicare. Medicare provides, provides the money, and then that comes from the federal government. So the government controls it that way, too. I'm not against the government, but I am for the life of the person. And people need to realize that when you give the control of your treatment over to the government with electronic health records and Affordable Care Act, you know, we hear about Affordable Care Act, and sometimes they abbreviate Obamacare, but it began with something for the patients at the first two words of that, and that's just dropped. The second word slips my mind right now, but it's the Patients Protective and Affordable Care Act. The patient protected just dropped, and we just hear Affordable Care Act, or we hear Obamacare, but the patient protection is dropped from, there was no patient protection. You know, along those lines, there's a movement for everyone to get palliative care, and 17 states have already passed a POLST law. That's POLST, all capital letters, and that's Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. There's no life-sustaining treatment that's given with the POLST Act. The POLST Act is to make sure you don't get life-sustaining treatment, and that's already passed in 17 states. It's going to be in your state, too, wherever you live, and that's a document that can be filled out when you enter the nursing home or wherever it is, and it's to make you sure you get less treatment. There's an article in the news about Emmanuel. Mr. Emmanuel says he doesn't want to live past the age of 75. Well, he's about 20 years younger than that now, but then at the end of it, he has something in their sentence in case he changes his mind. Well, all of these things are written to make sure that ordinary folks get less treatment. Ordinary folks have to pay attention and wake up and realize what's happening to them. And what we do, Life Guardian Foundation, we protect and preserve life is what we stand for. And we say no apnea test, no organ transplantation, because those things are not good for you to have.
Right. Oh my goodness. Well, there's. Thank you. We've run out of time. Thank you so very, very much for being on the program, and I hope all the listeners will go to the site, visit the site, LifeGuardianFoundation.org. Thank you so much for being on the program today, and we'll do this again soon. Thank you so much, so very much for all you do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Deanna.
All righty. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, bye. Listeners. Take care.
It starts with you and me.
It starts with you and me.